dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It's always a pleasure to be able to say we're joined by Bill Walton. He is, of course, a man of many parts. He has been active in Wall Street circles for many years, very successfully as a financier there. He has been, more recently, a leading force in the conservative movement in Washington, notably as president of the Council for National Policy, of which I'm proud to be a member. He is also, these days, a very active contributor to the public policy debate in his role as the host of a terrific podcast television program, The Bill Walton Show. Bill, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you.
Thanks, Frank.
You have been tracking China closely, Bill, both on the show and more generally. And I wondered what you made, as a financial guy, about the meltdown of China's vast real estate conglomerate Evergrande. This seems to be something that, with hindsight, of course, has been a building for some time. People have been talking about a real estate bubble. But I heard a fantastic statistic the other day, and that was that the Chinese real estate conglomerate doing business as Evergrande has more square footage now a building than would cover three quarters of Manhattan. And it now seems unlikely that that's going to be realized in terms of, you know, assets of value and sold and so on. What's going on with Evergrande, and what does it portend for China's not just real estate, but economy more generally, do you think?
Well, real estate in China has been a subject of speculation for years because they seem to keep building space after space after space. And three quarters of the size of Manhattan is about the number I've heard as well. Billions of square feet of empty residential and commercial real estate space has been developed, and it's keeping the economic plates spinning. And Evergrande has been pumping itself up. They don't have a lot of revenue from the property that they're developing, and so they've gone to the debt markets, and right now they owe about $300 billion to bond investors. And in addition, the number of dollars or whatever you want to denominate they owe to their vendors is even a much bigger number. Because if you think about all the subcontractors that provide services to building out this real estate, well, they're all in danger of not getting paid. Now, my view is that this is not going to be a Lehman Brothers type meltdown in China. China is just not going to allow that to happen. The markets seem to be, well, the market and the real estate firms, their stock prices are plummeting. A couple others have fallen almost to zero in the last couple of weeks. The contagion doesn't seem to have spread to other sectors. The Chinese central bank is just going to flood the real estate with liquidity. So I don't think they're going to let this hit that hard, because Xi couldn't stand a financial contagion. And more than anything, he's doing everything he can to preserve his power.
Well, that's an interesting point, because one of the things that we've been discussing now for several weeks is Xi's interventions in the capital markets seemingly are driving down the value of some of those Chinese entities. I've been told that perhaps as much as $500 billion has been lost in the value of U.S. investments in China alone, for example. We can talk in a minute about the implications of all this for Xi's political fortunes. But Bill, when you look at this, is there a limit to the ability of the Chinese to float the boat for Evergrande and some of these other entities that are now in considerable difficulty? And specifically, Bill, can they do it? Their, you know, government intervention capabilities, don't they require more money from us ultimately?
A lot of the dollars, or a lot of these bondholders, are Chinese, and so this is there's a big part of this which is an internal issue within China. You know, you might turn it around, Frank, and say, well, what point can the United States continue to issue its debt with now north of $23-24 trillion, and China is really just sort of, you know, following along with that. I think near term they probably can find a way to come up with liquidity to bail this thing out near term. You know, longer term though, China is still a shrinking country. Its demographic birth rate is like 1.3, which is less than Japan. It's incredible. The United States and its population may be shrinking, and so the Chinese Communist Party is racing against the demographic clock. And you know, the saying is the Chinese worry they may grow old before they grow rich. That's very much on their mind right now. So I think they're going to keep this going. We shall see. A lot of this, Kevin Rudd, a former Australian prime minister, is very close to the Chinese dynamics, and very interesting op-ed in the Wall Street. He thinks Xi is doing a lot of things right now to ensure his re-election to a third term in the next Congress. And we think of it, for outsiders, you tend to think of it as a lock, but internally, there's a lot of pressure on him to continue to deliver. You know, he's not. And, you know, the recent crackdown on the tech companies and the education companies, I initially thought that the crackdown on education was to prevent them teaching things that the Chinese Communist Party did not want taught. But it looks now more like it's trying to take pressure off Chinese families from having to provide extra money to support the tutoring of their children. And so it's really sort of a sop to the electorate, if you will. Not that China has a real electorate, but it smacks very much of U.S. domestic politics.
It is, by some accounts, the case that Xi is under some pressure internally. And you've mentioned a number of reasons why that would be so, Bill Walton. I think it probably is the case that this is both evidence of kind of his Maoist roots and ambitions, as well as his determination to try to maintain control internally. And what this always raises is a question about whether he may have in mind sort of social engineering and external adventurism as another means of managing that. What do you think?
Well, I think ideology matters a great deal to him. There was the swing to pivot towards capitalism under Deng, and for 30 years, they focused mainly on growing the economy and developing interrelationships with the rest of the world, and did so quite successfully. But now there seems to be a real movement to decouple from the world, and they think they may have gotten too interconnected. This may be ideological, or it may be as simple that they foresee real conflict with the rest of the world, and so they don't want their economy to be dependent on people like us for their critical supplies. I mean, we think we're highly dependent upon them, and we are for a lot, but turn it around, and they're highly dependent on us for a lot of the intellectual property that fuels their economy and their military machine.
Right, which they have been obtaining by hook and by crook, needless to say.
Mostly by crook.
Yeah, there's a lot of that going on, for sure. Hey, Bill, speaking of elections in China, there was a sort of stunning electoral process in Hong Kong the past few days, on Sunday specifically, I think. They had what's been described as a patriots-only election, which is their euphemism for only people hand-picked by Beijing were allowed to be candidates. And a trivially small percentage of the population, Axios reports it's as small as 0.6% of Hong Kong's population, was permitted to engage in the vote. Not surprisingly, patriots, as they're described, which is to say, you know, tools of Beijing, were elected to the next legislative council. What's your reading on what this tells us about the continuing Chinese crackdown on Hong Kong? And what might that mean in terms of its role in the future as a financial hub?
Well, my interpretation is this is a show of confidence from the Chinese Communist Party that they can conduct an election like that and not expect the world to recoil in horror and cause a public relations furor It's been underreported. I don't know if that many people have heard about this, but it's just another sign that Hong Kong is sinking under the waves as a free market and as a place where you can count on a capital market to raise money. Now, don't overlook, it's hard to overstate the cynicism of investors. I mean, if Hong Kong continues to provide a deep and a liquid market, they'll continue to be trading there. But everybody's now going to have to be mindful of the same risks they face in mainland China, which is the opacity will only grow. It's going to be unclear if you get your money trading in Hong Kong, how you get it out if the Chinese Communist Party decides that it's no longer in their interest to let you trade freely. So it's what we've warned before to all investors, which is that beware of putting your retirement savings in anything linked to the Chinese. And Hong Kong used to be in that category. Now I think it's clearly in the buyer beware category.
Yeah, that's such an important point. You know, we've been accustomed to China according Hong Kong, this so-called one country, two system status, and the rule of law continued to operate to a very considerable degree, consistent with sort of the British colonial traditions in Hong Kong. Not so much anymore. And I think you're right to warn that this is just another Chinese city.
We talk about ideology, property rights and rule of law is not in their lexicon. So as Hong Kong becomes more like China, my guess is you'd steer clear. The next battle line seems to be drawn on Taiwan. And so I think China or Hong Kong is something I've sort of put in the rearview mirror in terms of our ability to reverse the tide.
Well, I think most people have, and it certainly seems as though that's becoming more so by the day. And shame on us for allowing this to have happened without more pressure being brought, including, I believe, Bill, on the Chinese benefiting as they have and continue to do so from the sort of linking of the value of the Hong Kong dollar to the U.S. dollar. That seems to me to be a point of leverage that we could bring to bear. Let me, Bill, before we run out of time, we're going to run out of topics with you, that's for sure. But just back on this question of buyer beware, Gary Gensler, the chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission, seems to be responding, albeit slowly and grudgingly, to the growing evidence that there are problems. George Soros, among others, has been pointing them out in investing in China. And yet he has not yet tackled things like these variable interest entities and the fact that A-shares are being traded and over-the-counter stocks are being traded in our markets without the protections for investors that Americans are required to provide. Is the SEC, do you think, going to actually crack down on these various gambits of the Chinese Communist Party that it exploits to our detriment, I think, both from a national security point of view as well as from an investor's protection point of view?
Well, much to my surprise, it looks like it. I mean, Gary Gensler has come out saying that the SEC is going to begin to look very hard at the auditing of these Chinese companies. And the way he's going at it is a little arcane, but there's something called the Public Accounting Oversight Board, which audits the auditors. So if you're if you're one of the big accounting firms, PCAOB overlooks your methods and procedures and declares you with a good housekeeping seal of approval. Well, the Chinese have not allowed any single oversight of their auditors, and so they're saying now that the Chinese auditors have to comply with these rules. And I think there was a 3-year window. He's now talking about making it a 2-year window. And, it looks like he means it at the moment.
The Senate has voted to make it a 2-year window, amending a previous law you'd adopted, interestingly, unanimously in both houses last year, Bill. But unfortunately, the House doesn't seem to be prepared to go along with that. And the question really is, why 2 years? Why not 1 year? Why not 6 months? Why not move this thing forward if in fact we're watching, American investors losing enormous amounts of money at the hands of Larry Fink at BlackRock and others who insist that we have to keep pouring pension funds and the like, index funds and so on, into China. I welcome, you know, the general sentiment of Gary Gensler, but I wonder whether it's really, you know, it's sufficient unto the day, as they say.
Well, I think it's something Gary Gensler is getting used to, which is maybe protecting the United States from the Chinese and what they might do to American investors. I'm sure he's dusting off new parts of his thinking about this. George Soros, you know, basically said last week that the U.S. Gary Gensler ought to say right now that U.S. investors ought to be warned off from investing in Chinese companies. And so, you know, it's a difference, I think, between a mindset of a trader hedge fund guy like George Soros, which thinks in terms of, you know, daily trading and making things happen now, and Gary Gensler, who's got the typical Washington mindset as well, we'll be really tough. We'll change it from 3 years to 2 years or 2 years to a year and a half. No sense of urgency.
Well, very much driven by your former friends and colleagues on Wall Street, the old friends of China, like Larry Fink.
They're saying, don't be tough on the China. Don't be tough on these guys. They're all wrong. China's just fine. And in the meantime, they're making billions of dollars.
Yeah, yeah. Somebody said $100 million in Larry Fink's pocket alone from these transactions with China. It's staggering. And I think it's very much contrary to our national interest. Bill Walton, we have to leave it at that for today. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your expertise. Thank you for all you do with the Bill Walton Show. I commend it to all of our listeners. And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. In the meantime, stay well, my friend. Next up, we'll speak with Victoria Coates about developments in the Middle East from our expert on the matter at the Center for Security Policy right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Nancy Pelosi's handpicked partisan investigators are reconvening this week to promote her party line about an insurrection in Washington on January 6th, spawned by President Donald Trump and aimed at overthrowing our government. To his credit, U.S. Senator Ron Johnson has challenged that narrative, drawing on firsthand observations and analysis by my Center for Security Policy colleague Mike Waller. On Saturday, at an event I attended in Dallas, former New Mexico prosecutor David Clements flatly characterized the event as a false flag operation. Great reporting by Darren Beatty's Revolver.net suggests FBI agents and informants may have been among a small cohort of provocateurs determined to disrupt that day's certification of the 2020 presidential vote and vilify Trump supporters as terrorists, possibly with inside help. There's plenty to investigate about January 6th. Unfortunately, Team Pelosi seems unlikely to do it honestly. This is Frank Gaffney.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and I'm very pleased to say we're joined by Dr. Victoria Coates. She is a woman of many parts, an art historian, among other things, but also a former national security advisor to Senator Ted Cruz and to President Donald Trump, deputy national security advisor at the NSC during the Trump years. She is these days, I'm very proud to say, the senior expert at the Center for Security Policy on Middle East and North African Affairs. She directs our program there. And she is also leading the effort to help the rest of us understand energy as well as nuclear policy matters, both in the Middle East and in Europe. And we're anxious to catch up with her about both. Victoria Coates, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Always good to have you.
Thank you, Frank. Good to be with you.
Well, let's start with the Middle East and Iran. Victoria, there is much afoot there. It seems the clock is inexorably winding down. If what we were told about, 6 or 7 weeks ago, was that it would be possible for the Iranians to have sufficient nuclear fuel at an enriched enough state to have nuclear weapons capabilities in 10 weeks' time. Talk about the state of play, as you see it, the diplomacy, the efforts that the Iranians are making to fulfill their long-term nuclear weapons ambitions and the implications of all of it.
Well, it's a very disturbing time. I mean, obviously, the Iranians started ratcheting up their production of enriched uranium late last, or earlier this year, rather, and have been, you know, defying all of the pleas of their purported interlocutors, like, you know, the French, the Chinese, the Russians, and had just been sort of marching towards what most of us have seen as their logical conclusion for the last few years, which is weaponizing this material and achieving a nuclear bomb. And, you know, we're seeing this kind of agitation all across the globe right now. You might have noticed it's happening in North Korea as well. And it's a sign that these rogue regimes simply do not respect or in any way fear the United States anymore. And it's another reason why what's just happened in Afghanistan is so dangerous, because it signals further weakness. And I think, you know, the Iranians were still trying to come up with their negotiation team to send to Vienna in coming weeks, but they signaled this morning that their demand to get back in any kind of version of the JCPOA will be the full relaxation of sanctions. And so, you know, the president and his team will face a very stark decision then, whether or not they're going to cave to that demand or, you know, take a harder line. And I have seen no evidence of taking a harder line from that crowd.
Yeah. When you look at what the Iranians are doing to further preclude any kind of inspection or monitoring even by the International Atomic Energy Agency, this seems like even more of a mug's game than it has been in the past. Am I missing something here, Victoria?
No, I mean, you can't have a good faith negotiation with a partner who doesn't have a good faith word to give. I mean, they lie. That's what they do. And I mean, this entire regime has been based on lies for more than 40 years. So it's a pointless exercise, because they will say whatever they think they need to say to get their intended result, which in this case is going to be the relaxation of sanctions. You know, if the Biden team wanted to, this could be an incredible moment to put pressure on them. They're under enormous internal pressure in Iran, something we don't read about very much, but they, you know, have spectacularly bungled the response to COVID. And, you know, their already strong internal economic pressures have grown much worse from that. And so if the administration wanted to play hardball and really pressure them, this would be quite the moment to do that. Of course, they don't seem to be interested in that.
Too far from it. In fact, I had an interesting conversation with a fellow that I regard as a thoughtful observer of all of this. And his analysis was that the Biden-Harris team seems to be so set on elevating its ties to the Iranians and degrading its relationship with the Saudis that it may actually be intensifying the Saudi vulnerabilities, notably by pulling out new missile defenses, and heightening the Iranians' expectation that they can get away with even more direct action against Iran than through their Houthi proxies in Yemen. Do you sense that that's what is shaping up here? And more to the point, Victoria Coates, are you thinking that the Saudis may feel that way, and that may be one of the reasons why they seem to be more and more assiduously cultivating their relationship with the Chinese, including future oil sales and perhaps denominated in renminbi rather than dollars?
Well, I don't think we're going to quite be there yet, but I think you raise a critical point. I mean, literally 1 year ago today, I arrived in Saudi Arabia for a couple of months to the then Secretary of Energy, Dan Boreat, special representative to the region. And it was an extremely hopeful moment for U.S.-Saudi relations. The response to the Abqaiq attack from Iran in September of 2019, that was 2 years ago. This was 1 year ago. The Saudi response had been very robust. We had been very supportive. And, you know, as I told the Saudis, you know, this could be the dawn of a whole new chapter in our relationship, because we no longer need to be a supplicant to you for energy, but we can be a partner. And I had a long discussion with...
And that was because, of course, of the efforts that Donald Trump had made to enhance our energy independence.
Yes, and that you know, while we might be friendly competitors, it also opens up a whole range of possibilities in terms of coordination. And I came away from that trip very hopeful. And in 8 months, this crowd has completely undermined that relationship. And, you know, the wholesale removal of the Patriots, the removal of the Houthis from the terrorist watch list. Oh, they're suddenly friendly, like the Taliban. You know, it's just extraordinary to me. And, you know, and it's not just the Saudis. I mean, I understand people have issues with the Saudis over 9/11, over Khashoggi. You know, I see a 70-year alliance with enormous value and a partner with a great deal to offer. But I understand there are differing views on that. But look at what they've done over the last 3 days with the French. You know, as much as I am in favor of the Australia-UK pact, I think it's a great idea. Couldn't that have been better managed so that for the first time since the 18th century, the French recalled their ambassador? I mean, it's terrible. So, you know, these relationships we've relied so heavily on are really being dramatically undermined. And I think the Saudis are case in point.
Yeah. The irony being, of course, that this is an administration that came into office ballyhooing its foreign policy acumen and its ability to, you know, restore U.S. relationships with allies and so on. And of course, many of us were very skeptical of it, given the nature of this team and its past track record. But that nonetheless was what was promised the American people. Certainly has been anything but. Speaking of energy independence, Victoria, I wanted to switch gears with you and talk a bit about Europe. You have been raising an alarm about what's going on with the Biden administration's explicit encouragement of increased dependency by the Europeans on the Russians, specifically by eliminating obstacles to the completion of this so-called Nord Stream 2 pipeline. Give us an update on what the Russians are up to at the moment and the state of Europe's energy consumption and reliances.
Yeah, well, it's really turning into a slow motion train wreck, and there's not much we can do at this point to mitigate it because, you know, a lot of what Europe has done is focused exclusively on natural gas as a source for electricity and then also renewables such as hydro and wind. And by doing this, they have made themselves disproportionately dependent on Russia because they increasingly decline to produce natural gas domestically. And so they, you know, that let the Russians do that, through fracking or whatever means. But I mean, let the Russians do the dirty work seems to be, and then we will consume that gas. Meanwhile, we'll make all these lofty pledges about renewables. But then you wind up with a situation that we faced over the summer with there being a heat wave in Scandinavia, which reduced the hydraulic. There was not enough wind in the Baltic, which severely reduced the wind generated electricity, which means now it's all natural gas. It's all controlled by the Russians. And I think Putin saw this coming a mile away and slowly started reducing exports to Europe over the course of the summer. So he basically has them over a barrel now. There's nothing they can do except, you know, supplicate to the Russians to turn the taps on and get them more natural gas. And that
other than reopening some coal-fired plants that they had shuttered out of this preoccupation with global climate change, you know, alleviation, as they see it.
Both coal and nuclear. And that is also the sort of dirty underbelly of this situation is that they have had to reopen some coal. They're burning a ton of petroleum, and we're seeing emissions spike in Europe. And it's all the more ironic, given that they're all coming to New York this week for the United Nations General Assembly, where climate will be the top priority. And you will hear Boris Johnson, you know, be one of the top climate crusaders, the Prime Minister of the UK, and he will be making all sorts of grand pledges about getting to net zero. And this man is going to have to spend hundreds of billions of pounds in the coming weeks to stabilize their failing domestic energy sector. And then he had to ask the French last week to come over and fire back up a coal plant. It's just disconnected from reality. So I think there is real room for people who do care about the climate and who do want the United States to lead a responsible energy future to work very closely with our partners and allies on what that looks like so that we continue to develop new technologies. We're going to need them, but don't turn your back on something like civil nuclear, which is so much more efficient, clean, and safe than it was 40 years ago. And don't, you know, don't put your energy security security for an entire continent in the hands of Vladimir Putin. I mean, these seem like really simple things, right?
They're self-evident,
at least. No one will say them. Yeah, no one will say them because you get denounced and canceled as a climate denier. But hopefully what's happening in Europe will show us there is a way to do this that is responsible, that means there's plenty of power for everyone. We don't have something like the big freeze in Texas last February. We don't have what's happening in Europe now. It can be done.
Nuclear power has become something that at least some among the true believers in global climate change and, you know, man's role in trying to mitigate it are now championing nuclear power. And so we have this anomalous situation where the Germans have taken all of their nuclear plants down, as I understand it, and at the same time that they've created this vehicle for just precisely the sort of squeeze play that you've talked about now and we've all been warning about would be coming with the Germans lashing up with Russia on Nord Stream 2. So among other people who will be talking all this up, of course, at the UN General Assembly will be Joe Biden in his remarks tomorrow. And the degree to which he has reduced our energy independence goes back to what you were talking about with the Saudis. It does seem as though, whether it's out of concern about climate change or whether it's just hostility towards fossil fuels and the like, we're watching the fundamental transformation of America in a way that was very much the antithesis of what you and President Trump were working towards, and we're paying the price, among other places, at the pump, are we not?
Oh, absolutely. Our daughter is out in at school in California, and she's paying over $5 a gallon for gasoline. And, you know, the extraordinary spectacle last month of the American National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, issuing a statement in which he called for OPEC to produce more, you know, to release more oil to mitigate gas prices. And then the president coming out last week and saying, oh, it's all the price gougers. I mean, since he's now an energy analyst, he said, oh, well, prices should be coming down, but they're not. So it means somebody's doing something underhanded. No. And they can go on some witch hunt for price gougers who will never be found, but that's not going to solve their problem. And the problem is that we currently need more energy, and we are perfectly capable of producing it. And there are ways, you know, we could reorganize our energy sector to encourage increased stability and not see this kind of wild price walks. But again, I'm sure we will hear from him tomorrow, you know, very lofty claims about how the United States will, you know, lead the way in the charge to the renewables. And then, you know, I'm sure you saw Nancy Pelosi's comments in which she said, yes, you know, China is guilty of genocide against the Uyghurs and democracy suppression in Hong Kong and aggressive ambitions toward Taiwan. But all that said, and that's literally her quote, we have to work with them on climate. I mean, it's ridiculous. And so we will see.
Sounds like John Kerry, doesn't it?
Well, and I'm sure he has a hand in it, and I'm sure he's going to New York. But I think, you know, what we will see is this crowd just, you know, subjugate everything to this kind of article of faith, which is, I mean, to get back to your point, that we can somehow influence climate change. I think I'm in a slightly different place than you might think. I don't know that we can do that. I think we can take a very responsible approach to climate, and I think we can. It is absolutely in our best interests to exploit our technological edge and stay at the forefront of developing new technologies, because we need more power. And nuclear is case in point. We are the ones who can be developing these small modular reactors. We are the ones who can develop hydrogen generators. All of this that I learned about in the Department of Energy, this is all ours. And it's great. But why we should somehow make it conditional on what the Chinese want to do is mind-boggling. And so it's going to be quite a week for hot air being blown out of Manhattan.
Part of the climate change agenda that is working at cross purposes with stated one. Victoria, we have to leave it at that for the moment. This is a topic to which I hope we can return. I very much view that we have to continue to use responsibly, yes, but fossil fuels. And it remains very much to be seen whether moving inexorably in the direction of electrification is going to not simply put us more at the mercy of the Chinese with no lithium coming out of Afghanistan and other rare earth minerals that they control and the like, very much to the detriment of, well, national security as well as, of course, I think energy security. But that's a topic to which we will return with you. Thank you for your time today, my friend. Next up, we will speak with Sam Faddis. We'll talk with him about, uranium out of Afghanistan and whether the Iranians are going to be using that for the bomb, among other things, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back to one of the highlights of our week, which is our visit with Sam Faddis. Charles Sam Faddis is his formal name. He is a man that we have come to admire greatly for his past service to our country, both as an Army officer and as a clandestine services officer in the Central Intelligence Agency. He has gone on to do a number of other things in Washington State as an assistant attorney general in Maryland as a candidate for the U.S. Congress, and in his home now, Pennsylvania, where he presides over and does massively helpful work on andmagazine.com as a platform for news and information and analysis that I strongly commend to you all. He is the author, among other things, of Beyond Repair, The Decline and Fall of the Central Intelligence Agency. And we're always delighted to have a chance to visit with him about topics on his mind that should be on ours as well. Sam Faddis, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Great to be here as always, Frank. Thank you.
So much to talk about and so little time, Sam, but I guess a lot of it now seems to be your continuing attention, where I think it's really needed, on the ongoing disaster of Afghanistan. And I thought I might start by picking up on something we talked about with Victoria Coates in the previous segment, namely the mullah's ongoing ambition to obtain, it appears, nuclear weapons, and their interest in Afghanistan now in getting uranium with which they can be fueled from Afghan mines. What's up with that? And is this just part of the costs that we will be confronting for the strategic, humiliating defeat Joe Biden engineered there?
Well, I mean, the short answer to the last part of the question is yes. It's just one of the many pieces of the debacle, one of the many costs we're going to pay. The Iranians have experts on the ground in Afghanistan right now visiting mines and uranium deposits in Afghanistan, and are looking to exploit that and extract uranium. All of this against the backdrop of the fact that the Iranians have had ambitions to develop nuclear weapons for a very long time. They've never deviated from that. The Iran nuclear deal did not change any of that, that surrender. And there are numerous estimates out by this point that we're literally on the precipice of them having sufficient highly enriched uranium to actually begin constructing weapons virtually any time, literally within weeks. And we should also keep in mind that there's been a lot of reporting in the past about the fact that for many years they've been working on the engineering aspects of building a weapon, and also that they already have missile systems that can carry weapons, nuclear weapons. So what we're talking about potentially is having the material to finish assembly of a weapon and mate it with a delivery system. So we could literally go almost overnight from the Iranians not having nuclear weapons to the Iranians being able to nuke Tel Aviv and essentially have no warning.
We may indeed find them capable of nuking Washington or New York or other parts of this country as well, with space-launched so-called vehicles that could be used to lob a nuclear weapon our way, I think, too. And as you say, Sam, we have been told endlessly by both presidents of Republican and Democratic stripes, as well as Israeli prime ministers, that that won't be allowed to happen. So if you're talking about, as we did with Victoria as well, this being truly imminent, presumably, if action is going to be taken to prevent such a eventuality, that's going to be coming rather soon as well, would it not?
Well, if you mean it to be meaningful, yes, it better come any day now. But then the question, of course, is who's going to do that? I mean, the Israelis are one factor, and I think you could say that they clearly are more and more inclined all the time to act unilaterally because they feel like they've been cut adrift and are on their own. If you're talking about the United States under the Biden administration, with what we've seen, I presume nothing will happen other than maybe some ridiculous stern finger wagging and pointless diplomatic protests. I mean, the idea that Biden and company are going to do anything to counter this, I think that misunderstands the situation entirely. The Biden administration is in the process of surrendering to all of these enemies of the United States, not confronting them.
Enabling, for sure. At the very least, the Iranians specifically, as we talked about with Victoria. Coming back to Afghanistan, Sam Faddis, one of the things that you're reporting is documenting is that the administration is also enabling the Afghan Taliban with foreign aid, as well as the bequest of these apparently tens of billions of dollars of weaponry. Talk about our humanitarian assistance, some $64 million of it, as I understand, has now been pledged, as well as, for example, the significance of the encrypted communications gear that we've left behind for the use of the Taliban.
Well, as you and I have talked about many times, Frank, it's when you talk about Biden and Afghanistan, it's a little bit like Alice in Wonderland, right? It's when you listen to Blinken or listen to any other member of this ridiculous administration, what you hear is just fantastic. I mean, in the sense of literally fantasy, it's just one lie after another. It's a complete alternate reality. So, you know, Blinken talks in terms of conditioning aid on the performance of the Taliban. As he does so, basically, in the Congress, he makes no reference to the fact that USAID just cut loose $64 million, I think, in aid to Afghanistan, which means $64 million handed over to the Taliban. And there's some sort of nonsensical statement that we will have some capacity to control how the money is spent, which is obviously absurd. All of that money will be spent however the Taliban wants it to be spent. He also talks in terms of the military, you know, the military equipment and gear left behind, and wants to make it seem like it's of no consequence that we just turned these guys into a massive military force. And he wants to pretend that none of the equipment works. One of the things we recently wrote about that you referenced is, just as an example, the fact that the Taliban is now in possession of a significant number of very sophisticated, highly encrypted radio sets that they got from the Afghan army, and none of the crypto was deleted off of these things. So they have now gone from old school, you know, high frequency radio transmissions, decades out of date, to encrypted communications that are, let's put it this way, are unbreakable to a large number of people on the planet. Whether or not we can break some of those at some points, that doesn't change the fact that we just transported them into the 21st century in terms of communications. Obviously unaddressed in any of this, of course, is why there's the issue of why we didn't stop this from happening in the first place. There's also the broader question, particularly when it comes to vehicles and, you know, and armories and so forth. Why are we allowing them to have it? I mean, if there's a park, a motor pool filled with 100 MRAPs sitting somewhere, why don't we destroy that from the air and deprive them of the use of those vehicles? Why are we pretending that we can't do that?
These are, of course, the mine-resistant armored personnel carriers that were left behind, among other vehicles and aircraft and the like. And your question seems apt. I assume that the administration's view is that as long as they're trying to help Americans who want to get out of Afghanistan, as they euphemistically put it, to get out, they mustn't inflame relations with the Taliban. Or maybe they're just going to, you know, insist that the Taliban are our partners now, and we can safely allow them to have such equipment. But Sam, a question that's occurred in the past, and I don't know the answer to it, is there reason to believe that having these encrypted SINGAR communication sets in Taliban hands would not only harden their communications capabilities, which is a problem in its own right, but that they might enable the compromise of other communications, ours, for example, elsewhere?
Without question. I mean, one of the things that we've known now for weeks is that almost as fast as Kabul fell, the Iranians had people on the ground in Afghanistan taking possession of not only inspecting our military equipment, all of it, but also taking samples back to Iran to be reverse engineered. We know the Chinese have technicians on the ground working with the Taliban to help them locate the opposition, crack computer files, geolocate opposition folks. So the ISI, Pakistani intelligence, the same thing. So there's a whole raft of people here who now have a hold of some of our most sophisticated gear and have all the time in the world to figure out how to exploit that knowledge and, of course, reverse engineer it. And you're going to start seeing what amounts to Americans made in China, made in Iran, made wherever, you know, being used against us and our allies all over the globe. I mean, back to this principle of the fact that Biden wants to pretend that this is sort of a blip. Okay, Afghanistan didn't go exactly the way we wanted. It's all over. It is, of course, anything but that. This is a massive geopolitical strategic defeat, and we're going to feel the implications for a very long time.
Sam, I've been told, and I think your report reflects this too, that it's not just that the equipment has been left behind, but in many cases, the operating manuals have also been turned over to enemies of this country. So the damage there will be very substantial. I think you're right. Let me ask you about a thesis that our colleague Jeff Nyquist has been advancing based on reporting from some of his sources on the ground, particularly, I think, a former intelligence veteran like yourself, that the actual attitude of the Biden-Harris team to some of these Americans left behind, and certainly Afghan allies of this country that are still in the country, is that they are expendable, or worse, that it would be actually desirable to have them meet a terminal end, shall we say, at the hands of the Taliban, because dead men tell no tales, as they say. Specifically, that these are people who may have insights into just how appallingly the Biden team conducted itself and the consequences of it. Do you credit that thesis?
Well, I can say this definitively. That is certainly the appearance of what is happening. And I know for sure from multiple sources on the ground in Afghanistan that that is what they believe is happening. That the only possible explanation is they have been cut away. I also know anecdotally, for instance, that a former Special Forces officer who had recently been traveling abroad into Central Asia to help people get out of Afghanistan, when he returned to the United States, was visited by the FBI, who then demanded to know where he had been, who he had been meeting with, basically confronting him over his activities as if getting people out of Afghanistan was some sort of federal crime. And in his case, he ended up telling them, I'm not speaking to you. You can talk to my lawyer. But they were very aggressive with him. It was very clear that they did not approve of his activities and were attempting to dissuade him from doing any more of that.
I'm certainly hearing that from folks who have been trying to effect the extrication of Americans and Afghan allies, running into all kinds of opposition from the State Department in particular. And this does have a possible explanation in that thesis of Jeff Nyquist. Sam, in closing, let me just quickly turn to one other topic that you've also covered recently at AND Magazine, and that is China mobilizing its old friends, not just on Wall Street, but also in academia, to try to interpose objections to whatever limited efforts are being made by our government these days to try to prevent espionage or other operations, subversion, political warfare, and the like, being mounted by the Chinese Communist Party's operatives inside the United States. Tell us about Stanford University's professoriate in this regard?
Well, as we all know, or should know, the Chinese have been getting away with murder in terms of intelligence collection in the United States for decades. And a big part of that problem is just that they've been allowed to run amok. I mean, they just endless numbers of individuals. They've infiltrated academic institutions, et cetera. It's impossible to keep track of them all. Under the Trump administration, we began to turn that around with something called the China Initiative that the Department of Justice and the FBI took point on to begin to crack down, shut various institutes, push people out who were clearly engaged in spying. Since Trump left office, there's been a concerted effort across the board by all of the Chinese hirelings in the United States to brand this, of course, as racist, because it, strangely enough, it turns out that when you arrest Chinese spies, most of them are Chinese, apparently, and that of course makes it inherently racist, not a matter of common sense. Stanford has now, you know, joined in this effort, and we have this whole raft of academics at Stanford who have signed on to this. This is racist. This is horrible. It's all based on prejudice. You're just against Chinese people. And of course, the backdrop here is that Stanford, like so many of these institutions, has taken vast quantity of money from the Communist Chinese Party, huge amounts. And despite the fact that there are clear laws on this subject, almost all of it is anonymous. So even though they're required to report the identities of the donors, they just simply have failed to do so. And the Department of Education, well, at least was involved in an effort to force them to identify the donors. Whether that will go by the boards or not, we'll see, probably. But basically, you have an entire, I mean, I think Stanford is, if I recall correctly, has taken more money than all but maybe two other academic institutions in the United States from Communist China. So now, of course, they're singing the Chinese Communist Party's song. And the goal is obvious: shut down all efforts to stop Chinese spying and let them run amok.
Technology diversion research that's militarily relevant and the like being among the things that are being obtained in this fashion. You know, I was at a terrific conference that our friend Debbie Georgiadis had in Dallas over the weekend, and Gordon Chang was on a panel with me and laid out a very I think, helpful 7-point plan for what we do about Communist China. And sort of all of it could be lumped under, I think, the fifth of his points, which is reciprocity. And one of the things that just jumps out at you is that we have nothing like the kind of access in China to their academic institutions, their research centers, and so on. I mean, we may fund some of it, as we've seen with Tony Fauci and the Wuhan Institute of Technology, but the kind of penetration that's been obtained by the Chinese in our academic and, well, most other institutions for that matter is unreciprocated and both highly detrimental, I think, as well as scandalous in that regard, among others. Sam, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you for your time today, as well as all you do, most especially at End Magazine, and also as a very valued member of the Committee on the Present Danger of China. We appreciate you tremendously and look forward to our visit next week. In the meantime, stay well, my friend. We look forward to talking to the rest of you again.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Thanks for listening.